This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I'm Bill Hemmer. This is Hemmer Time. Mike Massimino, welcome back to the program.
Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
So that the audience knows, you're an American astronaut, you're an engineer, you're a professor at Columbia, and you're a senior advisor at the Intrepid Museum in New York. My man, I don't know how you sleep.
I take a lot of naps.
But you have great charisma and energy and an ability to simply explain really complex things. And that's why we love you here at Fox, Mike. So thanks for coming back here.
You're very kind, Bill. Thanks for having me. And very kind words.
Thank you, buddy. At the end, we're going to talk about Thanksgiving, but off to that in a moment.
Yeah.
So about a week ago, the Russians blew up one of their satellites. And they created all this space junk. It's hundreds of pieces. Maybe it's thousands of pieces. When you were in space, was space junk a concern of yours or others?
Oh, absolutely, Bill. It was especially after, and I flew on the space shuttle, and when we lost space shuttle Columbia, it was because of debris that came off the external tank during the launch. And so that debris came off, it put a hole in the wing of the space shuttle, and then when they tried to re-enter 2 weeks after the launch, to land, they go through the atmosphere and build up friction. It gets really hot, like 5,000 degrees, and that hot gas came in the wing and took it off, and we lost the crew, if you remember, back in on February 1st, 2003. So what that did is it heightened our awareness to things damaging the thermal protection system or damaging the pressure vessel, which is what keeps you alive. So it's kind of like, if you think of any of these, whether it's a space station or this space shuttle, the SpaceX vehicle, any of these things, we call them pressure vessels because they're meant to hold pressure, meaning that they have to keep the air inside so that you can breathe and stay alive. And if there's a leak, then there's a breach in that vessel, and then the oxygen and the pressure goes away, and that's what's a problem. That's why they were worried about this debris strike. Mm-hmm. So we were certainly worried about it, not just on launch, because it also brought up what happens if something happens in orbit. You can get hit by something on launch, with the shuttle especially was a danger, as we discovered, but also in orbit. And as more and more debris goes up there, debris is created, whether it's human made or micrometeorites coming in, there's more stuff around our planet orbiting now than there ever was, and it keeps increasing by large amounts. And every one of those things that's up there could be an obstacle. And if you run into one of those, the worry when you're in orbit is that it could breach the pressure vessel. Mm. And then that means, you know, you have to take action to either solve the problem or abandon ship or whatever.
I have to think that's like one of the biggest concerns of an astronaut, correct, when you're in space?
Yeah, I would say there's really like three things that require immediate response. And one is fire, you know, just like you would imagine on Earth. The other is which wasn't necessarily obvious to me at first, but it was caustic air. If something happens to the air you're breathing, if ammonia leak or something gets into the air where it's no longer safely breathable, then that requires immediate action because that can get you. And then the third thing was a rapid depressurization. Those are the three main things that really required rapid action because it could mean injury or loss of life. And the other stuff you usually could sort out and figure out. But if one of those things happen, when one of them is the depress, then you're really worried. We were really concerned up at Hubble. There is actually more debris up at the Hubble altitude, which is about 100 miles higher than space station. So even though it's a higher altitude, you might think, well, there'll be less stuff there, but there's actually more because it's at a higher energy up there. Uh-huh. When it goes into those high orbits, and it remains in those higher orbits for longer, so the debris can accumulate more than it will at the lower orbits.
So you're talking,
so the higher we were was a problem too.
Instead of 250 miles above Earth, it's like 350 miles.
350, but that was a significant increase in the possibility of of hitting something. So, you know, we were very concerned about it. We inspected the vehicle right after launch. This became customary after the shuttle accident, was to inspect right after launch and then inspect the vehicle midway through. We had a sensor package and a big giant boom, like a telephone pole, that we put at the end of the robot arm to inspect things. And then at the end of the mission as well, we would do another inspection to make sure we were okay to come home in case you picked anything up along the,
along the flight. I'm going to come back to this Russia thing because I'm going to read you a quote from the NATO Secretary General Hans Stoltenberg. Okay. He said this was a reckless act by Russia to actually shoot down and destroy a satellite as part of a test of an anti-satellite weapons system. I know we've got an anti-satellite system. I don't know how advanced it is, but I've always thought, Mike, that that's the way you win a future war. When you can defend your own satellites, it's game over.
Well, you got a good point. I mean, I don't know all the particulars about what the Russians did and you know, all the details in it, but certainly things are vulnerable that are in orbit. Just like I mentioned, a spaceship can run into a piece of debris. So can a satellite. So can anything else that's up there. And whether it's human-made debris or micrometeorites, which are naturally occurring pieces of material, mainly rocks and meteorites that come into our atmosphere, if they're coming in quite quickly and if they run into whatever it is up there, it can do a lot of damage. The speed is what it is. The speed that you're traveling in space, like my friends on the space station are traveling right now, 17,500 miles an hour. You run into anything going that fast, you're going to know about it. So even something really small can have a great effect on that. So the thought of creating more debris when it's not needed, yeah, that's certainly a problem. Everyone who has something in space needs to be a good citizen related to that and take care of it and try to consider what the bad outcomes might be if you're not conscientious about it. As far as what you said, yeah, trying to keep assets safe, whether that's a space station or that's a satellite or whatever it might be up there, certainly those things could be rendered useless with an impact. So something you want to protect.
So for it's sure. 17,500 miles an hour. You circle the Earth every 90 minutes. Is that right? Do I have that?
Yes, okay. That's at the low. Yeah, the lower. Now there are things that are even higher that that their orbital speed is actually at a higher energy, but they don't. They may stay at it with geosynchronous position, which means they're always over the same part of the planet. But they're at a much higher altitude to have that happen. So it all works out orbital mechanics wise, but it's all that stuff up there to remain in orbit of our planet is going somewhere around that speed, which is, you know, of course, really fast.
So, Mike, if you have ISS going at 17,500 miles an hour and you have space junk that doesn't travel at the same speed, is the ISS propelled into that orbit?
Well, the way the ISS was is that we built it piece by piece, and the Russians launched some modules, and the United States and the U.S. partners launched modules, like the Europeans, the Japanese, and the United States and Canadians launched modules on the space shuttle, and they were all put together. So that's how they were propelled to get up there. They were launched. Now that they're up there in the whole system, which is Russian, by the way, too. I mean, there's two halves pretty much to the space station, the Russian segment and the U.S. operating segment. There's cosmonauts. And right now we have Americans, we have Russian cosmonauts, and we have a German astronaut up there. So it's multinational. It's not like it's just one country up there. But it does have a little bit of propulsion in it on board. And so they can fire thrusters to raise or lower their orbit if they need to, especially if they're trying to avoid something. So that's a possibility, but it's not such an easily maneuverable vehicle. The space station is quite large. The inside volume of it's about the size of a 747, a huge aircraft. That's the amount of living room you have in there. It's big for a spaceship, but the truss work where the solar arrays are end to end are about 100 yards, like a football field. Long. It's huge. So that's not so easy to maneuver that thing. They can lower and raise orbits, but if you try to do an avoidance maneuver, it's not so easy.
Yeah. Last question on this. If you're moving at 17,000 miles an hour, even hitting something as simple as a bolt.
Oh, yeah.
That could cause enormous damage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The Hubble Space Telescope, when the telescope that I spacewalked on my missions, there is a high gain antenna dish, pretty big antenna dish that has a hole in it about the size of a golf ball. So something came in and found it there. And in the radiator on the wide field camera, which was one of the science instruments that we removed, it had an exposed radiator, meaning it radiated heat out to space. And it was this metal radiator that was curved that did that. And so things could hit it. It wasn't inside anything. It was exposed. And that thing looked like someone took a BB gun to it or a shotgun. It had all these dents in it, all these little impact craters from debris that it had run into or that came in and hit it on its way toward entering our atmosphere. You try to account for that by keeping, they do track these things, but also you build your spaceship so it can withstand impacts. And impacts do happen, but what you're really worried about is the one that will get inside and damage the inner pressure vessel, and that's when you have a leak.
Wow.
And that's what you don't want.
Really interesting stuff there. Well, let's hope for the best, right? I mean, the Russians have done it.
Yeah.
They've made a mess for a lot of people, and let's hope it all works out.
It's not good, for sure.
Not
that
cool.
Stuff's not good.
The last time we talked a lot about space tourism.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so, you got Musk doing his thing and Bezos doing his thing. Well, the one question I didn't ask you then is that, would you do it if given the opportunity? Or is that just like a cheap thrill, been there, done that, and, I've felt the G-forces?
No, I'd go again.
Really?
I would love to go. I wouldn't want to pay all that money, though. I'm not, that I wouldn't do.
But, Mike, this is just, you've been up there for days and weeks at a time.
Yeah.
This is like 7 minutes of your life. Why would you do it again?
Well, as far as it depends, when you mentioned, for example, Elon Musk, that could mean more than just a short trip in a parabolic flight. I mean, they go to orbit and they are starting to, there are going to be starting private astronaut missions coming up starting in January. So that's going to be another option for people. What we've seen so far, like with Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson going into space, those were suborbital flights. They didn't make it to orbit. And we mentioned the orbital speed is 17,500 miles an hour. But if you remember, Bill, the Inspiration 4 flight, which we talked about that happened, I guess, a couple months ago now, those were four people who were not trained astronauts who paid a lot of money. At least one guy did and treated everybody else, I think, the four people that went for St. Jude's Hospital awareness. They did not go to the space station, but they went into orbit for 4 days. So it's not just it can be more than just a 4 minute thing.
Gotcha.
Or 7 minutes or whatever it ends up being. It could also be an orbital trip. I think eventually those will become more common. We saw that one with that Inspiration 4 flight. I think we're going to see more, I would expect, next year. It could be more than that. I think, though, depending on it, for me, Bill, it's kind of like it's not necessarily the amount of time, it's the experience, but it's also the investment in going there. So as an astronaut, as a NASA astronaut, you spend years for that one space flight and then more years for the first one and then a bunch more years for the next one. I was an astronaut. It was 4 years. I was selected in 96. I was assigned to my first flight in 2000 and I flew in 2002. Then we had the accident we described, which I think slowed things down. And I wasn't assigned again until 2006. And then I flew again in 2009. So, those are years that go by of training and waiting and getting ready. And even once you're assigned, it took a long time to get ready to go. That's been shortened a lot by the automation involved. So it's more like a few months of training on how to do the spaceship and then what else you're going to do. So it's not as, the way I look at it is that the cost of doing that, it's gone down because the time cost has gone down. So, this thing that they do with Blue Origin, it's kind of like an amusement park ride. You walk to the top of the tower and you get on, I'll do that.
That's
good.
It's like Long Island, New York, isn't it? In the summertime.
Yeah. It's just like exactly what it is.
Who do you think has the edge right now?
I think it's hard to say. I think they all have their advantages. If we talk about it, I guess you're talking about like, Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos,
they kind of do different things.
Elon Musk,
is your point?
Richard Branson with Virgin Galactic. I think they all certainly have their own advantages. I don't think that they're necessarily competitive. And I think we're going to keep learning more and more. I think what's been amazing is how SpaceX has gotten people to orbit now pretty consistently over the past few years. And they're able to get more people into space. The training time has gone down. And as far as going to orbit right now, SpaceX certainly is doing really well. They're the only ones that have done that. The suborbital flights that Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos have accomplished, you know, Richard Branson is taking off and landing from a runway. So they have that part of it. Maybe one day it might lead to jet travel, or, you know, I should say, not sorry, jet travel, but rocket travel going from point to point. But Jeff Bezos has got kind of, I think, a very, very solid long range plan, where he's been successful with these suborbital flights, not just with people, but also with experiments on board. And he is building a big facility out at the Kennedy Space Center and tooling up to also get into the orbital game with a spaceship called New Glenn. So I think it's very exciting. And as far as who's ahead or who's behind, I think they're all doing really well. I think getting people to orbit, that was accomplished by Elon Musk, but I don't think Jeff Bezos is going to be far behind.
Yeah, it's interesting. Bezos kind of kept a lid on everything until he actually had his launch, and we're like, whoa, check, look what he's been building.
Yeah, right, surprise. I think he was a little more quiet about it, making sure things work.
Yeah.
And I think also he's privately funded from what I know. A lot of it comes from the money in Amazon or whatever that money is, that source of funding. Whereas with SpaceX, they have been winning government contracts for a long time. They started sending cargo to the International Space Station with the cargo version of the Dragon spacecraft years ago. And they did that under government funding. And I think there was also funding from SpaceX, Elon Musk, and other investors.
Musk maybe. Always, like, he always
was
put
a big NASA project.
Yeah, he always put a camera on everything. So we were kind of updated. Yes. But Bezos was like, right, hey, man, I'm pulling the curtain down. Check out what I just made.
I think he was a little more quiet. I think he was able to. I mean, when it's a government project, generally part of it is justifying the taxpayers' dollars that are being invested. So I think part of that also was part of the issue with SpaceX is that it's a government project, you know. So we heard about it that way. But I think also there, it seems that also in the culture and their approach, that Bezos was a little more quiet about things until he really had something to show.
Let's pause right there. More Hammer Time after this.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Okay, so another issue here. I think the government, speaking about pulling back the curtain, the government has made a very public shift, I think, in how it views UFOs. And The director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, quoted recently, there's always the question of, is there something else that we simply do not understand that might come extraterrestrially? Mike, for so long that our government shied away from this area. Now we know we're looking at it. How much consideration have you given it?
It depends what you mean, Bill. I think that, like, in other words, there are things that are flying around our planet that we know what they are. You know, a Delta Airline flight is coming into New York City. We know what that thing is. Or it's a small airplane, or it's a balloon, or a kite, or a drone. And we know what that is. And then there are things that that they know what they are, but maybe they can't say something about it. I don't know anything about this, but it could be some things are classified, for example. We don't know what they are. And then there are some things we don't know what they are. You know, these pilots are reporting things that they don't know what this is or that is, and it's moving this way or that. But just because they don't know what it is doesn't mean it's E.T. coming to say hi or take a look without saying hi, right? Sneaking around, taking pictures. That doesn't mean that at all. So I think it's quite a leap to say that, well, we don't understand what that is, so therefore it's coming from another place. It's we're being visited. So as far as I know, and I don't see how we would not find out about this, there is no evidence that we are being visited. That doesn't mean that there's not life out there. I think one thing we learned with Hubble, billions of galaxies with billions of stars in each and planets around most of those stars. In fact, most of those stars have multiple planets orbiting. So that the chances are there is something else out there. Life it probably is somewhere else out there, I think. But we just haven't found it yet, and I don't think anyone has found us.
Do your students at Columbia, are they interested in this? Do they ask you about it or not so much?
In the UFOs?
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, I think they're, in academics, I think I can't believe I'm about to say this, but you kind of deal with reality. I don't can't believe I'm actually saying that about academics, but you kind of deal with what, the facts and the proof, and it's not necessarily, they may ask about it, but it's not from the conspiracy part of it. We're being visited and the government's not telling us, blah, blah, blah. Generally, that doesn't come up. You also don't hear from them, like, is the world flat? Usually I get those questions when I'm outside of the classroom somewhere else. Not too much from my students, no.
Wow. Hey, listen.
Maybe they're scared to ask me because I might say, really? What are you doing at this school asking these types of questions? But I think the UFO one is kind of interesting because it keeps coming up, and what could it be? But again, just because it's we don't know what it is doesn't mean it's something extraordinary. And I heard someone say, I forget who it was, but I don't know if it was when I was in school or someplace, but for normal claims, you need normal evidence. For extraordinary claims, you need extraordinary evidence. So to say that something is an alien spaceship or something like that, we really need extraordinary evidence. I think most of these things can be explained, and those that can't, we don't know what they are, but that doesn't mean it's something extraordinary.
Yeah. Right. Well stated, by the way, too. Hey, listen, it is always a pleasure to speak with you. What are you doing for Thanksgiving, by the way? Like, what's your big tradition for Massimino?
Well, we eat a lot as an Italian family, but we're going to be, my kids will be coming over, and my wife and my sister and my kids, we're going to be celebrating here in New York. I think we're going to go see the parade. Friends of ours just got a nice place to view the parade down on the parade route.
Nice. Where is that, by the way?
I think of having people over. You want to come over? I'll have to give you the address.
Thank you, brother. I'm going to be in Ohio. How many times have you seen the Thanksgiving Day parade, being a New Yorker?
Not all that much, but I lived in Texas for a very long time. And, my father worked for the fire department, and his idea of a holiday was to stay home. Not even to get on the subway. So I think I saw it maybe once before I moved to Texas, and maybe once while I was there. So to answer your question, I think maybe a grand total of 5 times.
Wow.
And it's been 3 times. But I moved back to New York after NASA how long has it been? About 8 years ago. And I guess I've seen it maybe 4 times since I've moved back. And
I really love it.
It's just really a great day.
If you get good weather that day, it is very enjoyable. I agree. I've seen it a handful of times here. And I mean, for people listening, the secret way of seeing the Thanksgiving Day parade is to go to the Natural History Museum the night before. Because the night before is when they're filling all the air up into the balloons and they're blowing them up. And I mean, you've done that before.
I have, the Wednesday night before, they've got all those balloons. The Natural History Museum was nice enough to invite me to watch from their steps, watch the parade, which is very nice. But the parade doesn't start until after I don't know what the route is now, but the parade itself used to start just a few blocks south of the museum. But yes, going to see the balloons the night before, the inflation of the balloons right around the museum, that is something to do that's open to everybody. And now that you've mentioned it to all the people that listen to you, it's probably going to be crowded. But it's definitely worth it. And you walk through it. It's a moving crowd.
Yeah.
It's not like in a parade where people get in one place and they camp out and they don't move.
It's crowded up there.
It's packed, but they move. Their line moves to see the balloon. So it's doable.
Hey, listen, man, as I like to say, I hope you get a drumstick, Mike.
Yeah.
Have a great time with your family.
Bill, you too. Thanks for having me. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, man. And we will speak sometime between now and the new year. And who knows what's coming our way at 17,500 miles an hour.
You never know.
Thank you, Mike.
You never know. All right, buddy.
You got it. Mike Massimino, Intrepid Museum in New York, professor at Columbia, American astronaut engineer. He does everything. Thanks, Mike. I'm Bill Hemmer. This is Hemmer Time.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.